As About a Bookish Podcast. I'm Al.
And I'm Reggie.
And today we're joined by academic Vicky Brewster.
Hi!
Who's here to talk to us about the book The Death of Jane Lawrence. For those who haven't read it, it's gothic fiction where Jane ends up in a marriage of convenience with a doctor, but when she ends up at his house, she finds out there's something a bit more happening there than she expected. So to start off, Vicky, why did you choose this book?
I chose this book for a lot of reasons. I mean, the primary one is that it's one of the texts that I am studying for my thesis. I'm also part of a research grant fund for the British Association for American Studies, and I'm doing a project on it, looking at Gothic and medicine, because the man that Jane marries is a doctor in this world. I should say this world, because it's kind of an alternate universe that looks a bit like various different times of our universe, and in which magic exists, and magic and medicine are quite closely linked through a lot of the story. So yeah, I'm really interested in the queer gothic and the gothic medicine that happens in there, along with all of the other really cool gothic stuff.
Yeah, and when you say about the world, it's like, it's not, it's kind of alternate reality Britain, but it's kind of, it seems more based on Victorian era, but with elements of Regency and kind of covering that.
Like elements of the Blitz as well.
Yes.
Because there's been a war that Jane's parents died in, where there were bombings, and it sounds very much like kind of Blitz era London.
Yeah, and one thing that stood out to me as well is that Jane has got PTSD, and is dealing with that throughout the book as well. But in some parts, it kind of drives her on a bit more, in the sense of she's like, I face this, so I can face whatever I need to.
Yeah, it's definitely something that she uses as a motivator. And I think the memory of her parents, although she doesn't remember her parents particularly well, aside from the kind of the memories of being in bomb shelters with them, is something that gives her strength, I think, throughout the story.
Yeah. And it is, if you've grown up in the UK, you've probably, like my gran always used to tell stories about it being in Hull during the Blitz. We visited Ramsgate tunnels not long ago, and there's that, you know, the World War II has had a massive impact on this country, and you can still see kind of elements of it throughout. So it is kind of prevalent throughout the book as well. But like I said as well, that kind of Victorian and Regency element, and like I said before we started, it all opens almost like a Regency or historical romance.
Yeah, I should mention as well that the author is American. Caitlin Starling is American, but she has said in interviews that she's drawing very heavily on British history for this story. I'm not as familiar with Regency romance as I could be.
So some of them do start with that kind of marriage of convenience idea.
Okay.
One character is looking for someone who can support them monetary wise, or because of their status, rather than and inevitably they do fall in love. And because I have been reading more like historical romances recently, and it was really fun to see that kind of element. But you know it's going to be something a lot darker coming up. Like even the way she writes where they're kind of interacting with each other very much feels like a romance novel as well.
What I really enjoyed about it, being asexual, is that Jane feels very demisexual, and like she's not at all sexually interested in anyone. and her main motivation, it feels like, in getting married is a sense of security, but also a sense of usefulness. Because we have, how do we deal with spoilers on this podcast? Am I okay to just kind of charge ahead and mention things?
Say that there's a spoiler coming.
Okay, so there's a spoiler coming for quite early in the story, in fairness. So it's not going to ruin any big plot twists, but when Jane first goes to Dr. Lawrence's surgery to kind of work out this marriage proposition, a medical emergency comes in that she basically helps in a nursing capacity and gets drenched in blood and has almost this sense of fulfillment from it. There's a sense of disgust and horror in her, but there is also this sense of this is something that she can do. This is something that she can be useful at and she can make a career out of.
Yeah. And even when she discusses the arrangement with him and the arrangement being their marriage, it's kind of like, work for you, I can do your accounts.
Yeah.
For you. And it is emphasized to her that, well, yeah, but you also have to be a nurse as well. So let's get the ball rolling on that. But what I really liked about that scene as well is for her sense of fulfillment as well, it's when she starts seeing him in a different light and not just as a business arrangement, but she kind of starts realizing, okay, yeah, I might see something more here, but she doesn't like it.
Yeah, there's a definite sense of discomfort in both areas, kind of the blood and the romance, both, I think, give a similar sense of that kind of electrifying feeling that is both good and bad, that is attractive and unattractive.
Yeah, and she's very intelligent but very stubborn. Like, she, once she sets her mind to something, she will see it through to the end, and it's such a key part of her character, and I absolutely love that about her as well.
In many respects, it leads to so many of the kind of, not the negative things that happen in the book, but the trouble that she gets herself into from being so determined that this is the right thing to do right now, this is the way to fix things, and so often it's just leading her into more trouble.
I would say that Caitlin Starling's previous book that had the similar, it had a very similar characterization on both of the main characters, where they were just very, very stubborn and you can just see the disaster coming. And you're like, great, you two aren't going to stop at anything.
Yeah, I love that sense with these characters. And I think some of the supporting characters as well are such harbingers of doom, like the servants are constantly gossiping about terrible things, and then all of the doctors who show up who are Augustine's colleagues or who knew him when he was studying to become a doctor are all very into magic but also scared of what Jane is and what the house is.
Yeah, they start off quite, like, they just burst in and they're all very much like, well, we can just do what we want. There's a sense of, well, of like almost Oxford. You can tell they've gone to like an Oxford or Cambridge type university where it's very close knit from this group. But she's written it as well, so it's not like there's women who are in that group as well. It's not just men. There are women who have become doctors and stuff, which obviously in the UK at the time would have been more unusual than it is in this world. There's not a sense there that being a woman will hold you back.
Possibly depending on your class.
Yes. Yeah. There's that class element to it as well. It's another aspect that she's drawn in, where you can tell she's drawn on the on Britain for it, is the class aspect to it. Because Jane, like, her adoptive parents seem to be like fairly okay, but
they're kind of quite lower middle class, aren't they?
Yeah, but they're able to support her, but she doesn't want to go with them. She doesn't want to rely on them because she knows it'll put that added pressure on them as well. But yeah, and they all look at her like she's a specimen. Like, the doctors look at her like, who's this woman who's just appeared out of nowhere?
And it's sort of one of the mysteries that the doctors introduce into the story is, why is this, for want of a better comparison, Oxbridge educated surgeon who was very high flying come to this little backwater town to do the odd bit of sewing up farmers?
Yeah, they're really critical over his decision for that. And whereas Jane is very much admires him for it.
Yeah. But I think it is something that plants one of the many seeds of suspicion in her mind. about whether this is a Bluebeard story or not, which is something I'd really like to talk about.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so there have been quite a few Bluebeard stories coming out over the last few years. I think you said that you talked about Mexican Gothic on a previous episode. And I don't know whether this is one. There is definitely a seller that it's advised she not go to, but it's not in a kind of test of loyalty way. And there's the mysterious husband and there's the creepy house. So it kind of is and it isn't. How did you guys feel about that?
It's almost like it's if Bluebeard wasn't. Yeah, because there is that element. And to spoil a bit from a bit further on in the book as well. So if you haven't read it, maybe skip ahead a few minutes. It does turn out that it wasn't that he killed his first wife, but he was responsible for her death. If were they married or was it his fiance? But there is that element to it. But he's not whereas Bluebeard is just a villain. He really isn't. He's racked with guilt, but then it is his guilt that drives a lot of the haunting that's going on in the house as well, which I found to be a really cool aspect to it.
And again, big spoiler, it's kind of him that needs saving.
Yes. Yeah.
It's part of the reason that she actually stays in the house. It's not that she's trapped there and needing to be saved by someone else. It's very much that he's got trapped and she needs to save him.
Yeah. And there is this sense as well of. There is this thing throughout it as well of guilt. And because she does feel a bit of guilt towards what happened with her parents. And like I said, there's elements of PTSD as well that she's dealing with. She feels. And even to a point, she feels guilty for almost forcing him into this marriage. But she has to kind of push through that and come to terms with it herself. And it was a really good sort of theme throughout the book, especially contrasted with he comes across as quite a lot weaker than her as well. And I really like that because when you first meet him, you think, this strong, capable doctor. But it becomes really apparent quite quick that there's so many people around him who can just push him around.
Yeah, I think Augustine's characterization is really interesting, and I love that Starling hasn't gone to the place of just making him a villainous Bluebeard and has put him almost in this damsel position. But it's the same as we were talking about with Jane. So often his stubbornness, like Reggie said, his stubbornness kind of leads to everyone's downfall.
Yeah, and his unwillingness to actually talk, it's almost like he wants her to see him in a particular way, but he also wants her, he wants to keep her away from the house, but then he gets upset that when he thinks she's not there.
Yeah, he's full of contradictions, and I think he's very full of what people think that he should be in the way that he really is. I mean, you talked about Jane having PTSD. I think Augustine as well has some serious PTSD issues. And the way that they deal with it is in some ways very similar, but in some ways quite different. I think Jane, I don't know if it's because we sit behind Jane's eyes that we get to see how often it comes up for her and the way that she mentally processes it, whereas Augustine, it feels like literally shuts it in the cellar and tries not to think about it and just lets it be this horrible thing. Like the stipulation of their marriage is that Jane, is it that Jane never actually goes to the house or that she never spend that night in the house? It's something along those lines, that she must stay in town and she must not go to his old crumbling house, which is for me just massively symbolic of all of his PTSD that he doesn't want to deal with and doesn't want anyone to see.
Yeah, it's, I think it's not to spend the night there, but he's not expecting her to come there during the day either, because the idea is that she'll just live at the surgery.
He's compartmentalizing things very, like, he's building those like thick cement brick walls between each aspect, essentially, because he just doesn't want to deal with it.
I mean, literally as well.
Yes.
There are literal brick walls that are, that come out of, I think, very various people's emotional trauma kind of tipping over into magic.
Yeah, and that was a really good, like, because obviously magic is in so many different books as well, and I thought it was really unique the way that this was written, with the reliance on the emotional trauma, the way it affects the body. Like, the first surgery they performed together is a man who has an abscess because of the magic he's been attempting. And it's another aspect that when the doctors come, they're kind of like, they don't see Jane as someone who can handle the changes that would come with it as well. But they're very aware of those dangers.
I loved the way the difference between the magic, the kind of ritualistic magic that the doctors do versus the natural or spontaneous magic that occurs in other parts of the books. Because the doctors, for me, my dad was a chaos wizard. In the 70s through to the 90s, he was a big part of the London occult scene. And I've been reading his diaries from the 70s. And there is a lot of the kind of the ritualistic, but also it being a sense of it's something to try out and something to piss around with. And maybe something will happen, or maybe we'll just go on a massive acid trip. And it felt like there was so much of that in the attitude of the doctors when they first come to the house and they first try out a ritual, which goes very heavily downhill quickly.
Yeah, they're very oh yes, let's do this, it'll be so much fun. And then when it becomes apparent that there's something real going on, they all freak out.
Yeah. And it's kind of bringing it back to that Oxbridge parallel. It's quite Bullingdon Club, it struck me.
Yeah, and it is like there's always that sense, it's almost a sense of when you read like a couple of Dark Academia books, it's like them grown up, or even like TV shows like The Order and stuff, where they've got the witches and the secret society within the university itself. Yeah, and it's that almost obsession, I think, sometimes with what is actually going on in halls of education. When the truth is, there's nothing that exciting. Well, we don't think so.
I don't know if you've read Ninth House by Leigh Bardugo.
No, I haven't actually.
Oh, okay. So that's really interesting, because that is American and it's set at, I think, Yale College. I'm really sorry if I've got the college wrong.
It's been a while. I think it's like Yale, Harvard, one of those older Ivy League schools.
And that is also very much about class. Well, you don't really think of America as having certainly as much of a class system as we do here in the UK, but it's very much about a young woman who is sub-working class even. She, you know, she's a former junkie who was homeless and who is sofa surfing from her teenage years, who is transplanted into this Yale University secret society's magic happening kind of atmosphere. And there's that real tension between someone with a natural magic and these kind of rich kids pissing about with the very structured ritualistic magic.
Yeah, and I do think it's really interesting when people do have that intersection between sort of class and magic, and similar to, again, going back to The Order on Netflix, there's that sense to that as well, where the witches are kind of hoarding it in the same way that wealth is hoarded. But I read, and I've mentioned it, I think I've brought it up almost every podcast episode since, Babel, that I read recently, which is based in Oxford, but it's all about language, and they have, and in Babel, it's the British Empire and colonization and things like that as well, where they try, the magic works off translations. So you have these bars that have a word in English on one side and a word, the translation on the other, but it's about the gap between the two words.
Ooh.
But what they're doing is these older gentlemen who work at Oxford basically go out and sometimes they just take these kids from colonized countries, or in some instances they'll actually impregnate women and then go back and get the child when the child's about 5 or 6 and bring them back, and they're educated and they go in. But there's always this sort of, even though Babel is kind of seen as this highly esteemed part of Oxford, they are very much treated very differently by the rest because of the class, the ethnicity. They're sort of sponsorship kids who are just given everything. But you've got elements in there as well of, there's an Irish character who pops up, and characters from different parts of the British Empire. So that's also like, there's also that tension there that's kind of class-based, but also with the elements of colonization and ethnicity as well.
Mm. Yeah, and I don't know if you've read or seen The Magicians, but it does kind of go into that similar, it's very American, but it is kind of similar in that you, one, have to have an innate talent. You have to be of a certain age in order to get into the school, but then you have those who do not necessarily have the talent, or they had the talent and they let it waste away because they, instead of embracing the fact that they had this imagination, they had this strength, they instead succumbed to capitalism and just started hammering things down, like ambition is the only way in the corporate world. And you start to see that divergence with the people who have been accepted into the school and the way they treat those who are on the outside. And it does lead to a lot of issues down the road.
And yeah.
There's other things that go on with The Magicians, but.
And it is. Yeah, and the Magicians is like, it's post-grad level as well, isn't it? So that puts it even separate to a lot of what is out there at the moment. It's the next level up. And even like, it's almost particularly cruel with that, because they'll bring in people to do the exam and then wipe their memory.
Yes.
So they see the school and they see all the magic there. And then it's just, oh, actually, no, you're on your own. Bye.
Yeah. So like, they would come into the exam room and they would have to, it's like a big group, like you sit like a normal exam. And if you don't pass, it wipes, but somehow a few characters do manage to retain those memories. And that's where the problems start to arise. Some of the problems, there's other problems going on too. Like the one guy who can't control his jumping from space and time. So he ends up getting stuck somewhere. It's really interesting.
It is. It's a really great TV show. I absolutely love that. And there's that element of like, there's like a second world to it as well. It's almost Narnia like. That's a really good show, actually, if you like sort of academic based TV series.
Dark Academia meets like all sorts of crap. It just keeps going places. Everywhere you think it's going, it's like all of a sudden it pivots and you're somewhere else.
Yeah.
But there is that class element to it too, because you have those who are families. Their families are already magicians and it's expected of them. And then you have those who are like commoners, essentially, who just have that innate ability and all sorts of combinations therein. So it leads to some very interesting character dynamics.
Yeah. And I do think as well, like, I think there's a recent, like you said, there's a recent trend of kind of Bluebeard type stories, but it seems like Gothic is being used. Again, we discussed it a little bit on the Mexican Gothic episode, but the Gothic is being used more and more to explore these kind of themes, or taking a look like more marginalized authors are writing it as well. And there's a lot of interesting themes coming out through it that way as well. And like you said, this one, it's got that particular background of the war to it, and that is directly impacted Jane, but it hasn't impacted, it's almost like it's impacted that tiny section of the country, but not the rest.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very lucky doing my PhD now. My thesis topic is hauntings in 21st century fiction, and there are so many of them right now. And like you said, it's great to be hearing from more marginalized voices. Like, I think there's a lot of really cool ghost story stuff coming out of Latin America at the moment. Mm-hmm. one of my favorite, coming back into dark academia again, sort of, The Tenth Girl by Sarah Faring,
yes.
Which is set in Argentina, is fantastic and is weird.
It is so weird.
It's so weird. I love it.
Great.
Have you read her other book, White Fox?
No, it has been on my list, but I have such a TBR backlog. It is absurd.
Yeah. It's really interesting because it looks like her books are going to be set in the same universe, but on really disparate topics.
Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, so there were a couple of character names that it felt like were dropped in as Easter eggs for anyone who'd read The Tenth Girl. And then there are a couple of other bits where it's like, oh, that's a thing that happened in the meta world of the other book. Oh, okay. But yeah, she seems to really love an Easter egg.
Yeah, and I think we're getting a lot more kind of from South America and stuff as well. Like I've just been reading Our Share of Night, which is, I'll have to double check the author's name, but it's she wrote The Dangers of Smoking in Bed, which is a short fiction collection, and Our Share of Night is set in Argentina, but it's about like a cult-like group who the main character is this guy who has this particular sort of relationship, and he to the darkness, they call it, but he can channel it through him, so he has to go back and they all like worship him. But this, yeah, it's really good if you like kind of, it's not as much gothic, but it's, there's that cult element to it. It's centered around the disappeared in Argentina, and things like that as well. So yeah, that's quite interesting. There's a lot. It's really long though as well. It's taken me a while.
Something else that I'd really like to discuss about the death of Jane Lawrence is the ghost.
Ghost.
Yeah.
Ghost.
It's,
or if there is a ghost or if there is not a ghost.
That's the question.
It feels like a subversion of a classic horror, a classic gothic trope, even like the ghost of the ex, like almost peering over her shoulder at points and stuff. But yeah, and it's, there is that kind of uncertainty around it and whether or not, what is Jane seeing really?
Yeah, I think because we hear a little bit about hauntings from the servants, as we so often do in this kind of this kind of genre of book, but the ghost is very much a presence at various points for Jane, and this is one that I really don't want to spoil on the podcast, but the kind of the resolution of what the ghost is, it feels like it's something else that is really popular at the moment. Thinking about the TV adaptation of The Haunting of Hill House, or Katrina Ward's Raw Blood does something very similar. That's the text that I'm comparing it to in my thesis, which I don't know if you've read, but anything by Katrina Ward is amazing. She's like a rock goddess of horror literature.
I believe we've been recommended her at least twice so far on this podcast. And yeah. I do have one of her books on my shelf, but again, so many books are on my shelf that I have not read yet because I just like to hoard them.
Which one?
Oh God, I have to go downstairs to find it.
Oh, sorry, I didn't realize you were in a different room.
Yeah, sorry.
I'm lucky my to-read shelf is just above my desk, so it's always there.
No, I live in a three-story house, so...
Oh, wow.
Like, It's just really common here. It's like narrow but tall, like one of those old row houses. So half of the things are like downstairs, basically, in like the game room area. But I will find it and tell you later.
When we're not in the midst of COVID times, I run a gothic writing retreat, and Katrina Ward was our guest author at the first one. And it was just after Little Eve had been published and while she was writing The Last House on Needless Street. Which is the book that kind of made her blow up, where Stephen King said it was like the best thing he'd read in years or whatever, that really kind of launched her. So I like to say that we found her first.
That's amazing. Where is the retreat?
Oh, so we move around. It's called The Writing Haunt. The first one we held at Treowen, which is a Tudor manor house in near Abergavenny. And we like to go to houses that haven't had much modernization. So like Treowen has a little spiral servant staircase and it has a priest hole that you can go into. Yeah, we try to find venues that are old and leaking and haven't had much.
I mean, I would fly out for that just because we don't have that much here. I mean, like I'm in the East Coast of the U.S. So, you know, we're younger over here.
Yeah.
I have told the DHR contributors about St. Fagans and insisted come over and see it because it's amazing. Last time I visited, I was sending them all photos saying, oh, look, here's a house that's older than your country.
Yeah. Yeah, St. Fagans is super fun. We've got one of the, they have like a photo place where you can put on Victorian garb and have a black and white photo taken. And we've got one of those hanging around somewhere.
Like the most Gothic type architecture we have here is actually the university I graduated from, because it's an old women's university, but all of the buildings, everything on campus are these 1800s donated mansions. So yeah, I see your face.
That sounds pretty cool.
Yes, so we had ghost stories. There were speakeasies from Prohibition that were built in. So if you knew where to go, you could like sneak downstairs and have a party in the old speakeasy. And that was probably the most Gothic piece of architecture nearby.
That's one of the things we do on the last night is ghost stories by candlelight, which is a Victorian tradition where everyone has a candle and then everyone tells their ghost story. And when they finish, they blow out their candle until you're left with one person and one candle that gets blown out. And I had a migraine that night. So I asked one of my friends if they could kind of run it because they knew what was happening. But I was starting to feel a bit better. So I kind of came out of my room, which was just behind the dining hall, which was where they were holding it, and kind of tried to sneak out quietly to take a photo of them all. And they said they just saw this figure in white with a glowing box lighting up their face appear.
Oh, that's amazing.
And I thought that was unplanned, though.
I couldn't have done it better if I tried.
So I think I definitely need to come to one of them one day.
Yeah. We tried to organise one for last year, but was it last year or the year before? But it was just as Omicron hit in the UK. Yeah. And I think we didn't manage to cover the venue costs, so we couldn't run it. So I'm waiting until probably another year or so, because I'm waiting on a surgery. So I'll wait until that's done, and then hopefully everything will be nice and settled and we can go do stuff again without being terrified.
Yeah, because I think we're really lucky in the UK that we do have these historical houses and sites that we can go to. Like I said earlier, my brother lives in Margate. That's why we go down there quite a lot. And we've gone to the Ramsgate tunnels down there. I know I don't know if it's not long open, but I've only recently started hearing about it. Mary Shelley's House of Frankenstein in Somerset.
Ooh.
It's like a new attraction that's open there, but something I really want to do and go to. But
finding the non-modernized houses is difficult. I'm a LARPer, and I do quite a lot of kind of weekend horror LARPs at very fancy houses because we've all got to an age where we like sleeping in beds now. Not on the floor or in a sleeping bag. I get to go to quite a few of them, which is really nice. But yeah, Treowen's a super special place.
Yeah, I'm constantly like annoyed about how much Cardiff kind of will cover up history. Yeah, we did a Cardiff ghost tour not long ago, and the guy who ran it was fantastic, and it was only me and Rich who were there, because you basically book it, and if there's two of you going, he'll just do it. But that was really cool because I've grown up here, and the stuff he was telling me, I didn't know.
Yeah,
where the old slums were when it was the docks started, the World War II shelters underneath where David Morgan's used to be and things like that. And that was really interesting, just to get that kind of side of the city. I was just like walking around like, how did I not know any of this? It's literally right under my feet.
That's like the best thing about ghost tours, though, is that it's that bit of history that you don't learn about in school. A few years ago, I went on one here in my city. Apparently, we had the biggest civilian casualty incident in Civil War. Had no idea.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely no idea. And I walked past it. I worked near it, the site of it. And I had no idea that was what happened there. Essentially, the munitions plant blew up. So all the civilians making munitions for the North died in that explosion. And then they, you know, turned it into a park. So now it's a giant triangle-shaped park.
Yeah. It's one of my research areas at the moment is I'm looking at a couple of plays that have been on in London fairly recently, 222 A Ghost Story by Danny Robbins and Ghost Stories by Andy Nyman and Jeremy Dyson. And they are both very much about layers of reality. But 222 is, it's all set in the same room. And it's an old East End house that's basically being gentrified. So it's all been knocked through. Kind of there's exposed brickwork where they're repainting everything. And yeah, it's very about... we're back onto class again. It's kind of about the layers of class living in different areas and how they're still there in some respects.
We because we saw Ghost Stories live at New Theatre.
Did you see the original run of it?
It wasn't the original, but it wasn't, I don't know if it was the first,
because I think I was at the 10th anniversary run that they did just before COVID.
That was the, I think that might have been the one we went to, because it wasn't long before COVID that we went to see it, but it was
like the December before COVID that I went.
Yeah. And we went home and I was like, oh yeah, let's watch the film, because I'd never watched the film. And I was like, we finished the film. I was like, it was kind of disappointing when you've seen the stage production. I was like, we should have waited to watch it. But the thing in the stage
really
production, there was a couple who were in front of us and the girl was a nightmare. She just kept like overreacting and then she made her boyfriend walk out. She just dragged them both out and me and Mitch was like, oh my god, she was drunk.
Okay.
But yeah, once they left it was so much better. But it's when he's walking around the warehouse, that's one of the best things I've ever seen on stage. It was amazing.
It's so interesting to listen to Nyman and Dyson talk about it as well, because Andy Nyman obviously produces Derren Brown's shows.
Yeah.
And they both have a real interest in the stage magic of the kind of Victorian seance. And a lot of what they reproduce on stage is taken from that era of stage magic.
Yeah,
it's just being kind of repurposed with the 21st century.
It absolutely works. And I love going to the theater for horror stuff, because it can be so effective in a way that you're never going to get on film. And even like when you go to Disney Paris, because we did that in November 2019 as well for my 30th, and even stuff like Phantom Manor, the way they use Pepper's Ghost, and tricks like that to create these effects around you, I just find that really fascinating. And as good as the animatronics are, obviously they're constantly being updated and they're constantly you know, modernized, but when they've got the actual older tricks employed for certain stuff, it's just, there's just another element to it that's amazing.
Because I run horror LARP games, there's a lot of that kind of goes into planning set pieces for that and thinking about using all of the senses as well. Like, we quite often use smells. You can get like aerosol sprays of like bleach or different kinds of smells to trick associations with different things.
I'm going to have to come to one of them as well. And honestly, this is stuff as well my partner would be like over the moon about. We love stuff like that. We've done a couple of the like attraction type things. Like, we did the Rhonda Heritage Park for Halloween one year, the first year we were together, which we'd only been together a couple of months, and Rich, completely nothing phases him. So of course they start targeting him. And at one point he jumped and he slammed his back into me. I almost went down, managed not to, and he was ridiculously apologetic. But my favourite bit was this girl behind us turned around and went, I was waiting for them to get you. But yeah, we love stuff like that. We've done the London Bridge Experience. I've done that twice. The first time it was a lot better. They seem to have toned down the horror of it the second time.
They probably toned it down because BuzzFeed Unsolved went there.
Oh, I need to check that out.
Yeah, they went there. And I believe it was Ryan who just lost his mind. Because of course he did.
Yeah, because they're really good. When we did, I can't pronounce it properly, but there's one in Blackpool just outside the amusement park there. That's a walkthrough thing as well. We did it and we were the only two in there at the time. So that makes it extra terrifying for me. But yeah, anything horror related like that, we love.
Oh God, the best one. My husband and I went on our honeymoon to Amsterdam because it's got, I think, one of the highest number of escape rooms per capita. And we love escape rooms. So we went just to do escape rooms for like 5 days.
That's amazing.
And there was one in the catacombs of a church that was using kind of the in-structure architecture, I guess, for parts of it. But it was such high production values and the puzzles were amazing. At one point I was in a coffin being shaken around. And yeah, it was amazing. It was the best escape room we've ever done.
Yeah, that's really cool. I've done a couple in Cardiff. I did a Misery one.
Where was that?
It's the one, I'm trying to think of where it was now. It was off the Hayes.
Okay.
But they've got a couple of like film type ones. And as we were waiting outside, obviously they check, have you got any fears or phobias? No, we're fine. We walked in and I was like, I didn't tell them I don't like dolls. There's a all of them. Just, I was like, okay. And I was with, it was a work thing. So the team I was in was this really intelligent guy who, like, I got on with, but I didn't really know that well. And my manager's manager. So I was like, just keeping my back to the dolls. Like, don't freak out. Boss. Don't freak out. But yeah, I love, escape rooms are so much fun as well. But yeah, the dolls, there was a bit where you go into another room and I was like running through, just like, yeah, don't care what's in this room. Dolls.
You're like, no more dolls.
No more dolls. Do not like them.
Puppet Master is not the movie for you.
It's dummies, nope.
It's good that they've started checking phobias beforehand, because my friend and I usually have to check with people whether there's going to be an actor in there, because we get very punchy at jump scares.
Oh, I do too.
Totally fair.
I cannot do haunted houses here in the US because now we started getting those. So there's a couple of varieties of haunted houses here, right? You have your standard ones, you have like the tractor pulls, and then you have your extreme haunts. And we have one of the most extreme haunts in the United States here. It's called the basement. And I refuse to go there, even though people have been trying to get me to go, because not only will I get punchy, I will probably break the scenery trying to get out.
Hmm.
And you have to sign a waiver and everything, and they can touch you at that one.
Ah, yeah.
No, thank you. I do not want to be touched, so please do not touch me. I did
don't want
do
to be
the
in general, let alone in a haunted house.
Right. And I will say though, we now have a new tractor one where you get paintball guns and you get to shoot zombies. So I'm gonna do that one.
One of the my first like experiences with something on that level, like a horror like attraction, was my mum and dad took me and my cousin to Oakwood for Halloween. When the first years they did something for Halloween as well. And it was literally like, for the listeners, Oakwood is a theme park in West Wales. It's often called the worst theme park in the UK. But if you grow up here, like, I love it.
Everyone went for their school trips. Everyone.
Absolutely. You get to pan for gold. What's not to love? They used to have the mine ride that they turned into the Voodoo Mansion. So it was Halloween. They were only open for like 5 till 10. It was like £5 entry. We were like, I think we must have been about 11, 10-ish. And we went around, went on Megaphobia, all different rides, and caught up with my mum and dad, and I might have been a bit older because we all have to go off on our own and go meet them later. My parents were like, you have to go on it. And I was like, are you sure? Because I'm a skater. And they were like, no, go on it. Do it. So we went on, and I had been on the ride like before that, when it was not Halloween. They put actors in. When you sat in the car, they put a cage over you and locked it in. And it was me and my cousin, and then a young couple in front of us. So maybe late teens, early 20s. And as you're going through, it stops at one point. You could just hear really heavy breathing moving around you. And the thing that did help was actually the cage, because it was like, okay, they can't get to you. So me and my cousin were sitting there like, this is brilliant. And we go around a corner, and I was just like, oh, someone's going to jump out by there. Someone jumped out by there. But then another point, it stops, and you just hear a chainsaw revving. And then all of a sudden, this chainsaw is banging on the cage. And we got off the ride, and me and my cousin looked at each other and just went, that was amazing. We love that. It was brilliant. The girl in the couple in front of us was sobbing.
Oh.
His boyfriend had his arm around her, just leading her off. And me and my cousin were like, oh, but they would have just been like 5-6 years older than us. But I was like, we were just like, that was amazing. Found my mum and dad. We were like, yeah, love that. Great experience. And this girl's just pure tears.
I feel like we've really badly derailed the conversation.
It usually happens. No,
yeah, we always derail conversations. Don't even worry about it.
But yes, I think the writing retreat and the horror LARPing is... I need to do that one day.
I will send you details.
I want to do horror LARP. Like, I am so interested in the horror LARPing, because out here, all I get are the medieval LARPers with their broadswords. And I'm like, that doesn't appeal.
We have that too.
Yeah,
I know, but that's the only thing we have. All we have are those guys.
It might be, because a lot of the horror LARPs that I go to are quite kind of closed books, because they like to know who's going to be there, because it's a 24-hour timing. Quite frequently, they like to know that they've got people there who will stay in character the whole time, who they know what kind of the boundaries and the limits are, and are reasonably good with their own mental health, so they know to take themselves away from situations if they're becoming too much and that kind of thing. So it might be a bit more like that, where maybe if you check out with some LARPers, they would be able to recommend some stuff.
That makes
but
sense.
I know it's I know it's quite a different scene in America to the way it is in the UK. Because we've got all the Europeans coming over here teaching us Nordic LARP, and I'm like, no, I don't like Nordic LARP. Leave me alone.
I actually think I need to look into it, because it's not so... I didn't realise it was more of... Like, the reenactors, I know, is a big thing over here, but the LARPing, I don't think... Yeah, I think I need to... because I think me and Rich would really enjoy that, actually.
I will hook you up.
Yeah. Especially because there's got to be one around Cardiff.
There's definitely a like a fantasy type one that is a one day that my friend goes to called Fools and Heroes, which is quite nice and small community, and she really likes it because she's hearing impaired and she has chronic pain issues, and they're really good about kind of where they will hit her and where they will, like, not calling her name from behind because she won't be able to hear them and stuff like that, which it's really difficult to communicate with the larger fest LARPs. So she's always non-com at the larger LARPs, but she can actually go into combat with those ones, which is really nice.
Yeah.
The horror ones tend to be kind of where all over the country, wherever you can find a decent venue.
Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Yeah, I'll have to look into that. So anything else you want to say about the death of Jane Lawrence before we wrap up?
I mean, I was wanting to kind of draw it back to, did you guys find it scary, since we've been talking about being scared a lot?
I found it eerie. I don't think there's points where I was like scared as much, but more kind of eerie and wondering what was going to happen next. And I felt tense as well a lot.
Yeah, I think that's a really good word. I don't often get scared of books. I would rather not get scared of books, to be honest, because I get really bad nightmares and I like a good night's sleep. But yeah, I think especially in some of the medical scenes, there is definitely a tension that is physical during those reading those scenes.
Especially the patient. I won't say too much, but the patient that she directly deals with. That was, there were points there where, especially when she's left the surgery and is back at the house and you're questioning, and I felt really fearful for her particularly, and that was very brutal stuff going on there as well.
There's also a point in the story where Jane thinks that she knows the answer, and she thinks that she knows how to talk to the ghost, and she thinks that she has the solution, and then it turns out that she doesn't at all even vaguely have the solution. And that was a big moment for me of, oh, I don't know where this is going anymore.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where you're 2/3 of the way through the book and you're thinking, this feels like the end of the book, but there's still a good 150 pages to go. Where are we going?
that does always make me tense in a book when you're like, it does read like you're hitting the climax and you look and it's like, you have like 45 minutes left. You're, what else is going to happen?
I mean, for me, I don't tend to get scared too easily anymore. It's more like Elle said, it's more eerie and atmospheric for me. Could be just that I'm jaded, or it could just be that I find reality terrifying enough that horror no longer impacts me the same way. I'm not sure.
I think too many people use like horror equals scary, because I find like, yes, a horror film might make me jump, but it doesn't scare me. I think it's only once in relatively recent years that I've been disturbed by a horror, and it was the first episode of Midnight Mass, and it was the cats on the beach, on the beach. But I didn't realize how much it impacted me until I woke up at 3 o'clock from a nightmare of Tupac. And it was on that kind of level. And I can still remember it, because in my dream, she climbed out of the bedroom window. And ever since then, if she goes near the bedroom, I'm running in, closing the window. Okay, you can't. She wouldn't climb up there. She would never do that. But it's in my head. But
we're not going to risk it.
No. Other than that, there's not very much in horror that tends to deeply scare me. There's stuff that might disturb me, but not like full on scare.
I tell you what gets me usually is podcasts. I don't know what it is about, and I don't know if you get this because you listen to audiobooks regularly, but the Black Tapes podcast, the first series of that, I was having nightmares about.
That one got me with the sound design.
Yeah, the sound design on that podcast is amazing, and it's very good at playing those kind of very low bass sounds that are just deeply unsettling.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? Like, I think this is probably why books don't tend to scare me as much as like the horror experiences and attractions do. Or I think a lot of it's to do with the sound aspect, and if it is like the stage productions and stuff where they, you know, that kind of, it's the sound that builds up with One Man's Ego stories. A lot of it was to do with the sound and the beeps in the background, which is such a key part. So clever.
This is me plugging my research a bit more. Is I write about how the sounds in ghost stories in particular are unsettling because they're so loud and they're so distorted that you can't actually tell what they are until you get the context afterwards.
And it's like a penny drops.
Yeah.
I remember when that happened, I was like...
But when you just hear a loud noise and you have no context for it and... it's all around you, and there's an extra layer going on there.
I think stage productions as well have the added thing of you never quite know how it's going to go, because ghost stories, we thought there would be like someone coming out into the audience from behind and stuff, but they never do that. But it keeps you tense, anticipating if something's going to come from this, like, because we've seen Circus of Horrors a couple of times as well, and it's really enjoyable, but it's much more of an overt fear. Like, it's very much people climbing over the audience, and it's visual and all that element to it. Whereas Ghost Stories is very much more subtle to it, and the way they kind of draw out, and you're constantly waiting to see how they're going to scare you next. But that little girl, that still...
I will say that I think in ghost stories, the people sitting in the front row get quite a different experience than the people in the rest of the theatre.
That is true.
But it's why, like, I've said to Rich, it's like, if we go see comedy or Darren Brown, I don't want to sit in the front row. I just don't. He scares me.
Especially Darren Brown, because, you know, the kind of shit he's going to have you doing is eating glass and stuff like, no, thank you.
The funny thing is, Rich would be completely up for that. He would be volunteering. I'm just like, no, I like watching it. I really would love to see Darren Brown live, but...
I've seen him live. I didn't volunteer for anything.
No, I wouldn't. I'd be too disturbed, especially because you don't know what lasting effects he's going to leave you with. The most disturbing thing he's ever done in my mind is convince that guy he was a dummy.
I don't remember that one. I remember the guy that he convinced was in a video game.
Yeah, it was a couple of years before that. It was Trick or Treat. Series, which I think is on Channel 4, but he would get him to pick a card, and the cards either said trick or treat, but he could flip them around, so he was picking whether they had a trick or treat. And this one guy, he gave him a trick, and the trick was that he basically implanted in his brain that he was a ventriloquist dummy, and at one point he was on a stage with a dummy, and they put the dummy away, and the guy is left on stage going, "It's really dark in here, I don't like it, it's scary." And it has forever lived in my brain as like, no, I would not cope with that in the slightest.
That's fair. One thing I recently rediscovered, it had been a while, are Korean webcomics, the Korean horror webcomics. Mm-hmm. And they are a different breed of webcomic. As you scroll through them, you have sounds going, you start to see the pictures move. It is a very unsettling experience. You can mute the sound. They do give you the option. But if you don't know what you're clicking on, and you're just like, oh, this is a horror webcomic, I'm going to click on it, all of a sudden you get, like, phones ringing and loud bangs and things knocking on doors. It's not music, it's those atmospheric sounds. And it is very, very effective when they are done correctly. And I've recently rediscovered those, and I've been reading them, and it's just like, wow, did not realize this medium really existed. I had read a few years ago, but then rediscovering it, I'm like, oh, this has actually matured considerably since I last read them. So they are very folkloric as well. So if you don't know much about Korean folklore, you're going to learn, because there's shamans, there's anything that you can think of in these stories. They're usually standalones.
They sound terrifying.
They are unique.
It's where you're kind of phasing over almost into video games there, aren't you? And the kind of the video games that are interactive stories more than games.
Yes.
Which is the kind of game I like to play.
Yeah, so you probably would enjoy them.
Yeah.
Fab. Well, this has been really fun. thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So where can people find you online then?
Oh, so the main place where I hang out online is Twitter. I am at VProofreader. I can be found, my blog, which has book reviews and details about my editing services, are at my website, vickybrewstereditor.com. I also read tarot and blog a little bit about my dad, who I mentioned, and kind of growing up as the daughter of occultists, and you can find all of that kind of stuff on Instagram at Vicky Fox and Daughter.
And of course Reggie is
all right. Are you you did your little, like, I messed up my own intro, my own socials there. But yeah, so I am at Twitter most of the time, on Twitter most of the time, at Reggie C. Writes. Haven't been terribly active on there lately, but I'm working on it. I'm taking a break from social media. It's been a time with social media.
And you can follow the podcast at EsbatBookish as well. So on that, thank you very much for joining us today. And yeah, bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining.